Welcome back to the I Am podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in for this guest episode. So we've got Paul Selig coming up for you. He's a spiritual channel, which he'll let you know what that's all about when we get going. He's one of the foremost spiritual channels working today. He somehow manages to communicate with higher intelligence, higher consciousness, has an incredible message coming through him in ways which I just find staggering. So I really, really hope you enjoy listening to that as well as what it's all about. If you are really interested, you can find out so much more in a load of books he's written, if you can call it writing books, Bucks.
Yeah, that was an incredible part of the conversation. That's definitely one of my favorite parts, where he speaks about his process of how these books are written. Incredible. But there's 12 available, starting with I Am the Word, all the way through to the Book of Innocence, which are available on most good places, but also on his website, which Paul lists as the main place that you can get him.
Yeah, Paul Selig. selig.com. That's where you'll find out all about these books, these 12 amazing books. He'll tell you in the episode about how he's put them on paper. Also on the website, every Wednesday he's online, so you can hear from him directly. And if you want to see him directly, he's over in the UK, London and Dublin, where he's doing some channeling this summer. Wow, that would be pretty awesome. So what's coming up? The message is a big one. If you're interested in becoming all you're meant to be, and if you're interested in helping this world to become all it can be, then he's given you so much information around that, especially loads on what it looks like, what it feels like, and the how. So really excited, lots in there about breaking free of old cycles, breaking free of our past, recreating our past in a way, but definitely opening up the future too. So yeah, really powerful. And before we let you get into that, quick message from a sponsor, which is Number One Living Drinks. That's my brand, actually, so I can definitely vouch for this one. If you want to find out about us, it's number one living.com, and we'll give you a code as well, which is I Am, so capital I, capital A, capital M, 20, the number 20. That gets you 20% off that website. Fermented drinks, tasting great, all done in the most fantastic, traditional, amazing way, and designed for just pure health and well-being, and taking us to that next level of our potential, of what we're capable of feeling and experiencing in this lifetime, just like this podcast. So hope you enjoy that. And if you do have any thoughts come up to you during this episode, or anything you want to note them down, let us know, please do. Paul Selig, thank you so much for being with us on the I Am podcast. What a pleasure, what a treat I think this is going to be. And this is, for me, it's a little bit like the kid in a sweet shop. I've got so much to ask, but we're going to let it flow and let it go where it goes. But thank you for being here with us. How are you, first of all?
I'm okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Brilliant. Okay, so the I Am podcast, all about human potential. That's what we focus on. Maybe there'll be a bit of the backstory of Sparks and I coming into it at some point, maybe not. But basic gist, we spend a lot of time in competitive rugby, lots of interesting things going up there, and both have our challenges and where we come at this from. But when I say human potential, first of all, before we let people hear about who you are, what you do, when I say human potential, what comes up in you? What does that mean for you?
I suppose it means the highest expression of our being that we can hold. I think that probably is differently understood for different people. I know what the guides that I work with talk about, which is a level of realization of the inherent divine. That's where they come from. But I also think it's inclusive of perhaps the abilities that all of us have that aren't necessarily tapped into or trusted, or that we've been taught that we really can't have, so we don't even bother having the experience that's waiting for us.
Okay, wow. So you mentioned a few things there. That highest expression, that available experience, but you also mentioned guide. So before we get too far down that road, can you just give us a bit of an explanation or a backstory of what you do? Because I know it's maybe difficult for you to describe or put yourself in a bracket. But certainly there's channeling, there's psychic abilities there, but there's also your own story. Would you be able to package that in a small way for us?
You know, it's funny. I'm actually sitting here working on a memoir, so I'm having to look at all of this recently. So if I can get it down to to a soundbite, I'll try.
Doesn't have to be that short, please. That, whatever time you use here, whatever time you need.
You know, I work as a channel, which means that I serve as a radio for broadcast for a teaching that is not mine, but comes through me. So I'm basically a stenographer, a spoken stenographer for this consortium of guides that seem to work for me. They've dictated now 12 books through me, none of which require any editing. They're all spoken. Now they're all spoken in front of audiences. And that's what I become known for. The psychic work that I do is a little different. I look at them as different. I think of channeling as it's a form of clairaudience, but it's also a spiritual act, I think, as opposed to psychic, which is a bit more focused on, you know, what we want, what we think we're supposed to be, that happens at the level of personality. So they call me a medium for the living. So I don't talk to your dead relatives, but if you haven't talked to your sister in 6 months, you don't know what's going on. I can probably hear her and be, you know, it's verifiable. I often get to look like them and, you know, it's understandable what I'm saying. And I like that stuff because, you know, it's provable. The channeling comes with an energy that people feel. You know, it's quite something, which is why I've stayed with it for a long time, because I couldn't doubt it. I could feel it. So could the people that were there in the room with me. But that's a teaching, and that's a different thing. So I do those two different things. I came to this not because I was expecting to or wanted to. I was raised pretty much an atheist. And then I started opening up spiritually and psychically when I was about 25, when I quit drinking, which was a surprise too. So that was my journey, and it's still ongoing. I'm still trying to understand this stuff. It's unfathomable to me some days. I show up for the work as it comes, and that's really been how I progressed with this, you know, through the last, you know, almost 30 years or so.
I think I find it fascinating the capacity we have as human beings to respond to events in our lives. And it's not until we actually experience them that we realize what we're capable of doing in response. I ask, when something like this, as you said, opens up for you in your life, it's not kind of, oh, I've got a talent for ball sports like we might talk about. It's something that must surely shift the paradigm or the perspective that you have for life, because it's one of those things where I guess after experiencing that, how do you go back to what life was before? And what's it done to your worldview, having something like that open up in you?
It's a really interesting question, because it did change everything. And I used to say, you know, moving from a world where there is no such thing as God or source or spirit to one in which there is kind of like moving to another planet. And to me, it was earth-shaking. And, you know, it was also a process. It's not like I woke up one day and I knew everything. I don't. I don't claim to be ascended or enlightened. You know, I'm a man with some facility in some areas that's been developed through doing this work over the years. But at the time, you know, what happened to me was really funny. I was bottoming out in a hotel room, and I didn't know where to get drugs in St. Paul, Minneapolis here. I just didn't know. And the Gideons leave these little Bibles in drawers in hotel rooms in the States. And I went, well, why not? You know, I was in a crisis. I didn't know what it was. And I said the prayer. It said prayer for people in crisis. I didn't know what the prayer was. I didn't know what I was asking for. But 3 days later, I was back in New York where I lived at the time, and I heard a voice telling me what to do. And I did it. I followed it. And I stopped drinking that day, which is a shocker. It was the first voice. So I was suddenly primed to believe that maybe there was something else going on that I didn't know about. You know, I'm not religious still, you know, per se. And I wasn't raised with any of that, which perhaps, in my case, made me a little bit more receptive to what could be there, because I didn't have a narrow avenue available to me. But I had an experience a few months later of energy through my body. I had asked to be woken up. I thought, if you ask this, whatever this God thing is, to wake up to it, why would it want to say no? And I had an experience that people later said sounded like a spontaneous Kundalini awakening. I'll never know really what it was. I may have been hyperventilating, but I could feel it. It was energy moving through my body, out through the top of my head. And I started seeing the lights around people after that. So you know, I heard a voice, get your act together. I listened to it and I felt energy. And now I was seeing the light. So my world was beginning to tilt. And nobody knew what was going on with me. It didn't make any sense. I was a year out of graduate school. You know, I was a hard partying sort of rock and roll playwright at the time. I had, you know, aged blonde hair and well leather. And suddenly I was on this strange path, but I was on it. And I also, when I look back at that time, I had nothing else. You know, I was out of money. Everybody I knew seemed to be dying of AIDS in New York. It was a horrible, horrible time there. I had never been out of school before. I'd never really taken care of myself outside of working in a bar. So I was in a very interesting place where I started to open up, and then I kind of fell apart once I started opening. At the time, you know, 3 months before, I seemed to have it all together. You know, I was getting my work produced in New York and in the UK, and I was getting published and reviewed, and everything seemed to be happening the way it was supposed to. But, you know, when you have a list of what you think you're supposed to do in the world or achieve in the world, and you get the whole list and you're not okay, which is what happened to me, you start to reevaluate what's important. And in my case, I had been raised to believe that only stupid people had a belief in God or something like that. That was for other people. It was not for me or how I grew up. And I was, you know, just wasn't part of the vocabulary. And suddenly I think that I was given permission. And what that did, I guess this really answers your question. I was like, well, if there is a God or something like a God or something else going on in the universe, then nothing is the way I thought it was. That was what did it. And it was true. You know, I don't feel as devout. And I was in those early years. I was so hungry for something. But I have a level of experience now with this stuff that I think I take for granted. You know, I wasn't a psychic child per se. I had experiences, but I really evolved and developed through my own willingness. So yeah, it changed everything. It's still changing everything, I have to say.
And those guides that you're talking about, can you give a slight picture on like a daily basis how that works? Because like you just said, it's not at all what I think it is. And the issue for me is that you say this and I get my idea of how it works. And of course, I've got a picture. What is a bit more of obviously your truth of how this works? Is it there all the time? Do you invite? Are you sometimes just forced into the message? How does that relationship work? And are you learning how to have greater command or work with it? Where does that all fit in?
It's been a process, truthfully. When I first started hearing, I had studied a form of energy healing. And I was volunteering at a center for people that were living with life challenging illness. This was, you know, 32 years ago or something. I was maybe 30 years old, 31. And I found that when I had my hands on people's bodies, I started to hear things for them. So if I had my hand on your chest and I heard the name Chester, and I'd say, who's Chester? You'd say, well, my brother, my uncle, the man who heard me when I was a kid, whatever. And then all this energy would move. So as I kept getting verification for what I was hearing, I began to trust the station, whatever that was. It would sort of break through the chatter of my own mind. It had a very, very distinct flavor. But I wouldn't have called it channeling. It was the beginning of clairaudience, which I didn't even know what that was. And I started feeling in my own body what was happening with people as well. And that was clairsentience, but I didn't know that either. I started doing a group in my apartment around that time to see what would happen. I thought I would do my old teacher's work, which was not what I do now at all. And initially, I felt like somebody had their lips pressed against my forehead and was impressing the words. And my lips would form the words. And that was the beginning of channeling. And it's why I think I do this awkward thing of whispering and repeating that I'm just odd the way that I work compared to other people, but it's how it comes. When I quit smoking, I was a four-pack-a-day smoker, a lot of my life, when I was 48. And my guide said, we want to keep working with you, but you're going to have to deal with this. And I quit immediately. That's when they started to lecture. And the lecturers surprised me. I think I was so... I don't know what was impeding it, but everything really changed then. Everything, when I quit drinking, the psychic stuff kicked in. When I quit smoking, the channeling came to be more of what it is now. Initially, I was hearing, but I was hearing instructions for a group that were more about energy coordinates, ways to work with energy that was palpably. The energy would come. There was an attunement to this energy that they called the word, which they called the energy of the creator in action. But when the lectures started, things changed. And the moment I became willing to transcribe, record and transcribe the lectures, which I hadn't wanted to do because I don't like to hear myself do this stuff. Shortly after, they said, we have a book to write. If you take 2 weeks, we'll do it. And then they dictated the first book, which was called I Am the Word. And two weeks and two days, I took 2 days off to go teach. I was teaching college at the time. So the relationship has changed. And I actually do feel that my abilities have been clarified. Initially, when I first started, and it was interesting, when I was first started doing these little groups with these instructions coming, I was always so worried that I wouldn't be able to hear. People would show up. They were driving from two states sometimes to come and see me, and like nothing would come out of my mouth. I was terrified. And one night, I was about to do a group, and I heard from the guide, whoever it was, said, do we have permission to merge with you? And I said, okay, and I felt this whoosh of energy. And since then, it's not like I'm going someplace. In the old days, I actually felt like I had a tin can up to my ear, and I was just hoping that somebody had another tin can on a string and was going to say something that I would get. But it was frustrating. Now it's not. So are they always there? Yes and no. There's an aspect that I have access to that's always present. But I, when I'm channeling for a group or I'm channeling for a book, there's a whole different quality. So I look at it this way. When I'm channeling with somebody, if I was in a room with you or a grown client or were asking me questions, it's like I'm in the front seat of the car and I'm turning the wheel over to somebody next to me. When I'm really working, which is when they're dictating books or teaching, it's like I climb into the back seat and I give the wheel over and I'm still sort of half listening because I'm a conscious channel. And if they say something that I think just is too nuts or I don't understand, they'll say, Paul is interrupting. And I'll interrupt with my question. And they'll take my, they'll say, Paul is asking, and we'll say the question. And usually they'll answer the question. Sometimes they'll say, we'll get to this later. But it is a relationship. It's an odd one. I don't, you know, I've seen one of them a couple of times, three times, and he always shows up in the same way, and it's quite something to see. And I have students that are clairvoyant that have seen since the beginning all those monks that show up when I work. You know, people I've never met before saying there's monks behind everybody. And okay, great. I'm happy. That's who's coming. I'm happy as long as they're at help. But, you know, I mean, it sounds crackpot. It's just what it is. And the experience of doing this has built over time. I think we're in a period now where people, you know, read one book or they watch one podcast and suddenly they're a channel and they've got a shingle up and they're doing this publicly. And for me, it took a lot of, I really feel like I was apprenticed by them. You know, I was worked with, I did a group that met in my living room for 19 years, I think. Nobody knew who I was. I had a basket, people put 10 bucks in the basket, maybe 20 at the end. 3 people, 13 people. I wasn't looking to get known for this. I was just so interested in it that I kept doing it. It's only when the books came and my name was on the cover, which was a choice I had to make. I could have done them anonymously, but didn't feel right, that I began to get known for this. But all of those years in my living room, like a small group, I was being developed. I actually feel, and in stages, because my energy system can only handle what I can bring through. And I think that's true for most of us. We get sort of upgraded in terms of what we can do. I mean, I suppose if you're a runner, you don't run 20 miles on the first day that you're running. You probably have to build something. And it's a lot like that for me. You know, I had to be tempered. And some of that was through experience, and some of that was through very hard experience, truthfully. But for the for some reason, I just kept doing it. You know, I'm having to reflect on that now, but I'm trying to look at my life for a book. I'm going, oh my God, what the hell was I thinking? You know, what was this stuff? How did this happen? I still do that, but I like my life now in most ways.
Paul, if you don't mind me asking, how does the
And I suppose you could probably speak to this across the whole, as you just put it there, kind of through your apprenticeship and working your way through this and your experience with it. How does it affect you personally, physically, through these processes? Is it a feeling of fatigue and draining, or is it, in fact, the opposite, where it brings you more energy and you feel more connected?
It depends. It really depends. Some of it depends on who's listening. When I first started and I would do live events and nobody knew who I was, or people, it was guys full of crap or whatever, you could feel the resistance.
Yeah.
Kind of like speaking to a wall and the energy doesn't move back and forth. That's not the case anymore, because people that seek out my work generally have some quiet understanding, at least, of what I do. And there's a lot of video work out there online. So it's physically taxing for me. There's no question. It's a very physical act in a lot of ways. I don't always sit like I sit. I don't gesture like I gesture. There's a whole other thing that's happening. I'm told again and again, although I haven't seen it, that my eyes often change color when I work. They go very, very blue. And people have seen that for years and years now. But I get to see that. I'm sure it's on tape someplace. But the process, if it's a good channeling and a really intense one that goes on for, 30 minutes to an hour, which is, an hour is long for me now. Mostly they stop me at around 30 minutes. And I think that's so that my body can recover.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been swimming in the ocean. Like I've had a really good swim in the ocean. I feel cleared out and a little groggy. And I can feel energized. What I find interesting, because I had a channel yesterday online and I was like in a bad mood and I didn't want to do it, which is often the case. And they were terrific. It never seems to matter at all what state I'm in. I buried my mother and had a channel that day. It was like, here we go. And they're fine. I'm going through whatever I'm going through, but the broadcast is the broadcast. Again, I'm the radio. So I think the radio gets refined and it gets easier through doing it. I used to fall over.
We're just listening to that there. The partnership, if it is that, your own wishes within your own life, is there any assistance or guidance within those in terms of your intentions as Paul Selig being guided in any way? I've heard you say before that, the odd mention about, yes, this person is okay to trust, a good idea, that kind of thing. Or has it been more that this has become your life is almost with theirs now, or is there still, you and them?
I think there is a me and them. I don't think of myself as the guides. There may be some highly developed aspect of me that operates with them. That wouldn't surprise me. But I think, no matter how eloquent I might be, I'm not capable of dictating 12 books that don't need editing.
That's amazing.
Just nuts. When it comes to my wishes, they're not all met. Although I have to say I'm living a life right now that I didn't know that I could have ever, and I wouldn't have necessarily chosen for myself. And some of that's been about getting out of the way. And some of that's also an awareness, I think, that maybe they know, or some aspect of me knows what's actually good for me, which may not be what I want for myself. But I maintain independence. The guides talk about the importance of free will, and they do talk about unifying will, the personal will, the higher will, and how that can move to a unified state, which I believe then is just simply moving to a level of clear cognizance, of a simple knowing, when you just know what to do. Not like somebody's piping it into you, now do this, now do that. I don't think it's about living that way. But I do feel supported. I have to say, I do feel supported, but I'm still single. I'm still complaining about it. That's been a complaint. I'm seeing in this damn book. We're like, I'm complaining about it, but it's forever. But I'm living in a funny, it's funny. I was thinking about this recently. I'm living in this house in Maui, which is a place I would never go to Hawaii. I had a bad date in Hawaii once. I said, I would never go back. I'm living in Hawaii. I wound up here during COVID. And I'm living in a house that looks like a house that I used to draw on some computer game. 15 years ago, The Sims, I used to make this little house with lots of windows, French doors all over the place, and gray floors. And oddly enough, that's where I wound up.
Wow.
It was right to me.
Yeah. Amazing. So you mentioned you started to get into the message there that comes through from the guides. I've heard you mention that the guides is a name that has come from maybe you or your surrounding, not from them. What do they represent for you in terms of what would you describe them as? Is it like a higher consciousness? Is it an actual kind of another civilization or a different, what is it? How would you best describe it if you could, do you think?
I would describe them as teachers that are operating at a different level of consciousness, that hold an awareness that is much more vast than I can myself. They've called themselves, in the first book, they call themselves teachers. They might say ascended masters was a word they use, which I don't like, they haven't used it again with me. But the name that they've come through with, when there has been a name, has been the name Melchizedek. If you wish to call us something, you may call us this. And somebody else had said that's what I was working with, and I was like, yeah, right. And then I heard it from them later. And the one guy that I see has a very specific way of appearing, which does seem to, fall into how other people have described that guide. They're called the guides because my ex, many, many years ago, when he found out I could do this, used to say, ask the guides this, ask the guides that. That's why they got called the guides. And I actually prefer the simplicity of that because I don't like all the attachment to names that sometimes you hear in spiritual communities, because I think it gets to be about ego more than anything else. Anybody can say they're channeling anybody, and do, as a matter of fact. And I think the test has to be the quality of the teaching and the energy that accompanies it and its effect on people's lives.
So this, if you are 12 books, I know the last one, 2023, and like you said, without editing it, just incredible. I try and write a paragraph and it takes me about an hour once I've gone over it.
I struggle to send you a text message without having to go back and change it, to be quite honest with you.
So, I mean, that's ludicrous. But how would you, again, this is not a soundbite at all, but to kick off the next part of the conversation, the message or the biggest parts of the message, what is it? Because I mean, for us here, we are really behind this understanding in our journeys about moving from this survivor state to the creative state, which feels like a journey from being very solid, very physical, into the more subtle, the gross, the more outside of those senses, the more open, trusting. But that for us is important. And I resonate hugely with so much of what you talk about. But what's the message there from the guides and also that you understand?
What I understand is that there's an aspect of all of us that they call the divine spark, the true self, the monad, the Christ within. There's lots of names for it and lots of different schools. That this aspect of us, and called the I Am Presence, if you like, which many people do, is seeking to know itself through us and actually realize itself through us in form, which is trippy. But it's how they teach. And when they teach, they come through with energetic attunements that work on the physical self, the energetic self, and the ideas we hold of who we are, which support us in a higher level of demonstration or realization. They call it expression. How you serve, they say, is how one is most fully expressed as the true self. It just means, I think, that we have overly identified with an aspect of us that has been entrained in what they call the common field, which is, the inherited reality and structures of reality that we've known and what we expect to see and unintentionally replicate because we've always known things to be a certain way, which actually claims us in a sense of separation, which they say was never true. So it's very much a teaching of reuniting with the aspect of self that knows who it is, as they say, I know who I am. I know what I am. I know how I serve. That aspect of self that knows those things, it seeks to express that through us. I think that's one way of saying it. But it's a teaching of rearticulation. They say the common field or reality as we know it is an octave of tone. We have low notes and high notes, but everything exists within this octave. And they say any piece of music can be, what's the word, transposed to a higher octave. And that's the process of what they do. They call the higher octave the upper room or the next level of awareness that we can hold or embody in. And the teachings are all about moving us to a level where we can be realized there. It's not about escaping this world. It's actually about re-knowing this world beyond the lens of separation. You know, they say God is all things. You know, you don't get to cherry pick what it is. It must be all things, inclusive of the bodies that we hold and what we see out the window and that person that we can't stand and those things that we don't want to see. But they do say that when everything is renown or realized anew as unsourced, things are altered through vibrational accord. So it's a teaching of vibrational accord, finally. They say everything, you know, they say you're in accord with everything you see. A-C-C-O-R-D or C-H-O-R-D is on a piano. The music of your being is calling to you one experience of reality. You go to the higher level, you begin to call another kind of experience to you.
And that lower level of separation, of individuality, of that discernment, that kind of, it feels to me the black and white, the evil, the good, the right, the wrong, all that kind of stuff. I certainly felt that separation, or I recognize that separation even within myself from that I am presence. And it's come manifested as fear in my life. Just an ominous sense of darkness that as especially as a young child, just you couldn't, there was nothing I could put a face on it to even help me, because it was worse than death, because it was just so unknown. At least death had a kind of, you know, had some imaginary parameters, but this just, and my life has been guided essentially by reconnecting and reclaiming, if you like, that experience. But the fear feels big at the moment where we are. And when you talk about moving to a higher level, what is the, as you mentioned, you know, energy, vibrational accord, all those things, what's the lower level? Is it fear, the anger, the...
Yeah. I mean, it exists within the octave, but that's the low notes. I mean, the guides I work with have said, you know, fear is also of God. It just denies it. You know, it just refutes
wow.
it.
We're yeah.
Ill of them because it has to be. All you don't get to, and that's the problem with the dualistic thinking, you know, which is it creates more of a chasm, or that it requires somebody to be made wrong, you know, at any time. The guides have said that the action of fear is to claim more fear, that every choice we make in fear gets us more of the same.
Wow.
They said, look at the last choice you made because you were frightened of something and see what it got. Probably it got you more fear. It's been the case for me. I had a childhood similar to yours. It was not easy. And the thing that they've been teaching in the last couple of years, which has surprised me a lot, is they say that we're born into a field where fear is so omnipresent that we expect it. It's like you're jumping in, you know, you get born, you jump into the pool that somebody already peed in and you don't know it. You know what I mean? It's already polluted with this stuff. And so we expect it. And when they take people to what they call the upper room, which they say is the next octave, they used to say, once they brought people there, what are you afraid of? And nobody would have anything to say. And they said, well, fear doesn't exist at that level. You know, what you're doing is you're transcending the reality. Fear doesn't get to rise to that level. You can transmute it. You can clear it. You can do all kinds of things, but you don't get to carry it with you, you know, in the higher way. And some of that requires, I suspect, that we disengage from our attachment to what we think should be, because it's when things aren't what we want is when we get frightened.
You know, that's fascinating. I certainly recognize in my life that in fear, you have those kind of thoughts and that are inspired out of that fear. And I've been trying to answer those thoughts hoping it will turn my fear into joy. But like you said, it's all born out of fear, and the solution is born out of fear. But the ability to somehow move to the energy rather than follow the end of the chain where the fear is, but move to the source and work there to shift seems very, very powerful. But it's the attunement that you're talking about is that kind of what's being done here, the inner work as such.
I don't think it's a magic wand, nor do I think this is all a quick fix. I don't know that it works that way. In the very first book, which was called I Am the Word, the guide said, humanity is at a time of reckoning, and a reckoning is a facing of oneself and all of one's creations. And everything that's been created in fear is going to need to be re-seen or recreated in a higher way, which is a whole shift in how the world works. And I don't know if I recall what your question was.
The work of the attunement. Is it working? Is it working on that energy space in helping people to come to a? Because for me, a lot of that deeper work has been done through almost like humility, the sense of humiliation, of feeling like I have to sort this out and to sit and not do it, and to realize that you don't have the answer, nor do you have to have the answer, and it feels so vulnerable. But it's in that space that there's possibility almost.
I agree with you. The attunements work to support us in a realization of what already exists. There's a very simple teaching that the guides have, which has helped me a lot. They say, who you put in darkness, what you put in darkness calls you to the darkness. Or even more simply put, what you damn damns you back. And that would include your thoughts or the things that you fear. And they, when they talk about blessing somebody, they say what you bless blesses you in return. You know, a blessing isn't a platitude, as they teach it, like it's come to be. Well, blessings and prayers for the people that were hurt in that shooting, you know. They say blessing something is realizing the inherent presence of source where it has been denied, or bringing the action of the divine or source or God, or whatever you want to call it, the light, upon the thing that's been in darkness, which actually alters the thing, which we don't know. We've come to think of all this stuff, I guess, as magical thinking at best, and not sort of the power of thought that we have. And when I talk about the power of thought, I'm not talking about magical thinking, like I'm going to think about a cake and somebody's going to bring me a cake. I do think it's about how we negotiate reality through our awareness. Here's an example. The guides have said, we've been at war for so long. They say, since the first person picked up the first rock to throw it at somebody else, we've been at war for so long that we expect to have it. And our idea of peace is a cessation of war, not a level of consciousness where war is impossible, which they say is something that can be realized and known. But we're operating by a rule book, I think, of what has been, and we expect to get what we've had again and again and again. And we do. We're creative at that level. So I think we get to think beyond the box if we're to have change. And I don't think that we can do that by ordering off of the old menu of what we think we're allowed to have, which is limited to what we've known historically. And I think the opportunity is to claim a different possibility for who we are and what we have capacity for. I don't know if I'm making sense, but
that's incredible. I think because it's quite often spoken on an individual level that if you keep doing the same thing, you're going to get the same results. But I'm not sure how often it's applied on a much more universal scale, the kind of humanity as a whole, that, you know, if we do believe that these are the parameters and this is the framework that we must operate within, then we are kind of destined to continue to do the same actions again and again ad nauseum.
Yeah, I agree.
Karen.
Yeah.
I was going to say that lower vibration, the fear, the upper vibration then seems to be, like you said, the recognition of the divine is in that love in the respect of recognition that we are all one. And albeit there may be, in this experience of life, there may be a need to navigate through, and that we may need an understanding that certain actions are damaging according to where we want to go, but it isn't bracketed as evil, right, wrong, good, bad, but there's this understanding that, because that's certainly the answer to the fear I had, was to sort of, I guess, move closer to myself in a recognition, like you said, that there's divine in everything, and there's divine in the worst thoughts that come up. There has to be. And to have that. But is it that shift towards, because that humiliation I was talking about earlier, and the deep acceptance that is part of that, seems to remove the story that we have for ourselves in that moment, you know, to accept and just completely allow, almost just extinguishes the fires of right, wrong, good, bad, must, shouldn't, did. And in that space, when you're without story for you, you're without story for anyone else, that possibility is there.
Absolutely right.
Wow. That's so powerful. And so this time we're in now, having had this period, I guess we've had for, you know, the last so many years, and you hear so many people talk about, we've never had it so good in terms of luxury and in terms of, you know, it's some of us, because in the past we've had this, but at the same time, there seems to be something about where we're living at the moment in terms of the COVID and how that seems to have uprooted so much, or at least shown us so much about where we are as a civilization, where our systems are, even within yourself. You know, you get in your house for a bit and suddenly you find you can't handle this, and your family breaks, and then you, whatever. But also the wars that are happening, the divisions taking place everywhere. Is there anything specific about this time? Because I know, you know, go back 100 years and you've got the First World War. Now you're kind of like, well, surely that must have been a kind of revelation of what, where we are as well.
I don't know. I mean, I know what the guides talk about. I have my own opinions about stuff. When they were dictating this book called The Book of Truth, which was dictated right before the U.S. presidential election with Trump and Clinton, and they said everything that's been buried is about to be revealed. And they said, imagine you're living in a house and you've got an archaeological dig going on in the backyard, and things that were buried 5 years ago and 5,000 years ago are all going to be coming up, and it's going to look like crap for a while. You can imagine all that digging and all that dirt piled up. They said the reason is not to be able to point fingers and blame and find villains and make things wrong. It's an opportunity to heal what has been held in darkness. Again, who you put in darkness calls you to the darkness. Simple, simple teaching. And this is the process that we've been in. And like 3 days before the election, they said, I was teaching, it's actually online in a lecture someplace. They said, well, it was a lecture call, I think it was called Great Change. And they said something like, your idea of choice is I'm going to have the milk or the cream in my coffee. And what's about to happen is what happens when the table holding the milk and the cream gets turned over on its side. And that's what happened. It really was. So I don't think things lighten up for a while. I really don't. We have choice as a species, they say. They've said, and which is very helpful, and I don't like predictions, but I think they actually did talk about COVID without naming. I don't think it was named yet, you know, before it happened. They said that humanity is going to make it. They said we've got about four generations until we start to see the change. And I think that the people that are being born aren't coming in with a level of attachment that people of my generation were about how things should be. When you're around systems that are collapsing all around you, you stop trusting in a status quo. And I don't think that that necessarily means anarchy or bedlam. I do think that it means that there's the opportunity for the new to be born. Well, I taught college for 25 years, and I watched kids, you know, the 18 and 20-year-olds show up. Generationally, I watched how they were changing. And I remember right before I left teaching, maybe 9 years ago or something, some kid got up on the stage for a class that I was teaching. I was sitting up there already, and he dropped a folder full of papers all over the stage, hundreds of papers all over. And all the kids in the first row, without saying a word, just got up and picked up all the papers and handed them to him kindly and sat back down. When I was a kid, everybody laughed. Everybody
exactly.
And I went, wow, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
People are changing. There's another kind of awareness. And it makes me very, very hopeful, I have to say, what's to come.
I feel, go on, Sebastian.
No, I was just going to ask, I don't know if this is going off on a tangent, because one of the things that's coming up in my head as you're speaking is kind of that question of almost like a time question. Do you get the impression from the guides that the kind of the partnership and the relationship that you've developed with them, they've had with people before?
Yeah.
Do you feel like this is that they've kind of seen that they've either been here constantly or at times where their message is the most relevant and needs to come out in order to create that shift?
I believe that. They've said as much in the books, that this teaching is present in every generation in a different form. I suspect that I've worked with them before in some other way prior to this life, but, you know, I don't go there that much.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I worked a number of years ago with a woman who worked with prayer, and she liked to read me little things that she found that she thought would help me. Before we'd sit. And she read this one thing, and I said, wow, that's really great. When did the guides say that? Because it sounded just like them. And she said, oh, that's not the guides. I think it was somebody named Spangler, who I didn't know. And there was some guy out of, maybe that was the guy, I think he was out of Findhorn in Scotland. And then there's a few other people, and I go, wow, I understand what they're talking about. So I don't think that this is new stuff. I think what's different about how the guides come through is they come through with a level of energy that's palpable for people. People read the books and they have experiences of the energy and of the guides. It's very, very common. When the first book came out, nobody knew who I was and or what to expect. People started reading these reviews on Amazon saying things like, I'm reading this book and my body's vibrating. I'm reading this book and I'm seeing auras. And that's what the guides said would happen. They're supporting the student in their understanding of the work through the process of reading. So I'm hopeful for this, but I don't think this is new stuff. I think it's probably much, much, much older than we think.
Yeah. It does feel to me there's, in that space of challenge, like you said, when these things get kicked up and we see them and we're all challenged, whether it be by fear or anger, or even challenged by this need to sort it out or whatever it is, that, as you said, when we go through what's been to try and get to a new answer, we just end up with more of the same. But that relationship with challenge to kind of soften, contemplate and see it on that energy attunement level, it just feels like a massive opportunity. I mean, is that almost, I look at, you know, individually, we're always talking about what we can do to save the planet, save the world. And everyone has their ideas and it's brilliant. But as you just said, the message is the future is the opportunity is in the attunement, the work. And it always seems that there are people there that are working at a level that are saying, bringing about a deeper conscious awareness within every individual is kind of necessary. It's not something that can be put off till we sort this out. In fact, it is the sorting of that maybe.
I think we're having to look past the individual to the collective now. And I think that that's a very positive thing. One of the apt criticisms of the new age, you know, when I first came into this stuff, when I was in my late 20s, and that was the thing, was that it was selfish. And you still hear people saying, well, I'm going to manifest this, as if manifestation's about getting something. And what people miss is that we're always in creative mode. You know, how everything that you see, you are in energetic accord with, energetic alignment with. It's not just the thing that you want. You've also manifested the crap that you don't want, and there's probably a reason for it. And that's not necessarily your fault. Some of it is the systems that we're all in alignment to. So, you know, I used to get fed up with people when they'd say, well, why did so-and-so create their illness? Or why did I create, well, I mean, if you're living in a town where they're dumping chemicals in the common well to save money and people are getting sick, the problem isn't that you did something to drink the water. It's that you're living in a world where that's condoned and supported, and that we have opportunities in the collective to make hopeful change. And that's how I see it. So when we move past selfishness as the purpose, then we become inclusive. And then I think we become generous. And then our hearts can open. And then we can know more and have more. I've been a very selfish man in my life at times, and I've suffered from it. And I hope I've learned some more than I used to. You know, you mentioned COVID. It was the funniest thing. I lived in Manhattan, and the guides had said in a live stream, there's going to be a big thing coming to Manhattan, and you're not going to like it. And I said, well, get me out of here. I said, you know, New York during 9/11, I was downtown. I don't want to go through this crap again. Just get me out. I said, let me be someplace pretty. But me and my assistant be someplace pretty when we're on the road. And we were in Costa Rica channeling at the time. And New York shut down while I was there. It went on lockdown. I couldn't go home. And I had no place to go. I didn't know where to go. And a friend of mine said, come to Maui, and found me a little tiny house to stay in. And got me a plane itinerary. And I was on Maui 2-3 days later. And I never left, pretty much. Changed my whole life. I have a whole different life than I would have chosen, but I got rerouted, you know, and I think COVID was a rerouting opportunity for a lot of us. And I think in some very, very hard ways, and hopefully eventually some positive ways as well. I think everything finally has to be seen as an opportunity to learn.
Yeah.
We don't have to choose the lessons, but if we don't see it as an opportunity, then we're a victim of circumstance.
Yeah. Jeez. Wow. Yeah, I mean, the collective side of it is still one that I find a really interesting balance, because like you said, there's so much happening, which is you can see and question why, but it's the energy with which you then sort of approach the problem. Because if you then come back with the same energy that's probably creating it, you kind of create more of it. And it's almost that kind of peaceful resistance, if there was an oxymoron, or that kind of passive resistance or whatever it is, or the ability to act with the grace and with the beauty. And as you said, seeing the divine in everything maybe allows for that grace and beauty in bringing about change in a fairly curt and decisive manner where it needs to be done, but not in a way that then exacts more revenge coming back at you afterwards and cycles and cycles.
The guides have said that self-righteousness is always the small self. It's always the personality self. And it's a hard one, but it's true for me. When I'm up on my high horse and I'm being judgmental, I'm operating at that level, which is a very small lens. One of the problems, and the last book the guides that was just published, it was the Book of Innocence. There's another one, the last one's coming out in the fall. They talked about memory and the role of memory. And they said the problem we're having is that all memory that we have was accrued through a lens of separation. And consequently, none of it's accurate. It's only accurate at that level. But imagine you had a camera lens with a gray filter, and everything that you see is tinted gray because you've never known anything other. So because that's what we've known, that's what we choose from. And they talk about how even memory can be renown in the divine. You know, you bring that power, that light, whatever you want to call it, through memory itself, you can begin to release the scales from the eyes or the gray filter from the lens and see what's really there, not just what you've been taught to believe is there or should be there, you know, whatever. I mean, I do stuff that I didn't believe in. It's fairly normal for me now, which to my mind means that everybody's capable at a level of accessing abilities that they were told couldn't be there. I was told they couldn't be there, so I didn't bother. Or they were for a few people. You know, I don't think that's the case. I think we have far more capacity than we know.
Do you think that we are in a time where we're starting to experience a greater push for that? There does seem to be a greater proliferation of people wanting to hear alternate voices and seek different narratives or different, and just try to at least gather information so that you can actually make your own mind up about things rather than be fed, this is the way it is, this is what's happening.
I think that's true. I think some of it's fashion, you know, and that will pass, which is, you know, the idea that, I mean, I live on Maui where everybody's a shaman here, it seems, some days, you know, it's not a talk. But, you know, it's part of what's going on. But I do think that the awareness is present, and I think it's encroaching. When I started doing this work, I got a website finally when I was about 48 or something, without my name on it and without my photograph. I had a regular job. I was in academia. I didn't want to be discovered. I didn't want to be ridiculed. And now it's acceptable. You and I can be having this conversation. I'm not worried about somebody coming and trying to lock me up or saying, you know, you must be wrong. You know, it's part of a conversation. I don't care if anybody believes what I believe. Like, I'd have passed that, and I have had experiences that work hard around being public with this work. But the good news is I mostly don't care anymore. That was the fruit of it. I don't care. I show up for what's mine to do. And if somebody's helped by it, that's great. But I meet people all the time. And I always was. They were just in the closet. I used to, you know, have a practice as a psychic, you know. I used to get judges as clients who were psychic themselves. They just couldn't talk about it. Well, I mean, it was just not discussed. And I do think that we all have experience and we all have potential. And that can be developed. But in my case, that stuff was the result of spiritual growth. It's not because I was trying to be psychic. The stuff came, my abilities, such as they are, came in complete service to other people, not to get me what I want. You know, I still have people that I go to consult with because I can't always read for myself because I have an investment in outcomes as it relates to my personal life, whereas I can be neutral for you guys.
Yeah, well,
it's easier.
That's amazing. I think that's really big. I think that, the neutrality and the ability, like, for example, Sparks, when you were saying about not wanting to be sort of given opinions or given this, but actually my own memory, I have that relationship with, you know, I know when I have that self-compromising thing about feeling something and it hurts so much to feel it and think it, that I know I don't want this to be me any longer. Mm-hmm. And it feels like a lot of you mentioned about the expression, the truthful, authentic expression, which then serves by itself, finds its place. And a lot of this and the fear and the need to get yours before someone else gets theirs and get your own back. But the ability to get out of our own way, all that, like you said, that learned, the historic side, it feels to me like that's a very worthy endeavor, if it is an endeavor, but at least a surrender to be able to find who we really are and who we're really supposed to be, as opposed to follow that kind of, this is exactly as you said, who I want to be, you know, what I want to get, you know, to strategize my way to the top. I was fortunate at the age of 24 to have pretty much ticked off all my goals, but then got faced with a very revealing truth, which is there's no pot of gold at the end of that rainbow, and that rainbow wasn't even a rainbow. It's almost like that's a privileged understanding, but it feels like getting out of your own way, whether that's part of this attunement, whether that, yeah, the alignment and everything, it's fascinating. And finding other people that can bring you that space when you can't have it yourself, finding that community, that sense of comfort and safety. Wow. I imagine you provide a huge amount of that in everything you do, not just for us on this call, but in terms of in those groups.
I like to show up for the work. I'm not a spiritual teacher. I'm not a guru. I don't want to be. I don't claim to be ascended being, you know. I am along for the ride, and I'm happy to share the experience with people who are going to benefit from it, if they're going to benefit from it. You know, I like the work. I may never fully understand it. I still have questions around all of it. I think that's not unhealthy. Part of me, I was raised a skeptic. I accept at this point that whatever is happening is beyond me because it just keeps happening. And that's my job. But do I help people? I hope so. You know, but am I? I have community here on Maui. It's very funny. I had it in academia. I had colleagues and students and people that I cared about. But I ended up moving to Maui, oddly, you know, near the Ram Dass community.
And wow. Yeah.
My brothers and my friends, and I'm very grateful that I feel welcomed by them. You know, it's been a nice, nice thing. So I like community. I don't like tribes. I don't like my tribe, because that always feels exclusive to me somehow. And I think everybody's your tribe. You know, people have common interests in different areas, but I don't need to be be drawing those lines anymore.
I think you've given us so much of your time and insights, wisdom, you know, fabulous. There's one little thing that I wouldn't mind just asking you now towards the end, because some of these experiences, they feel a little bit like, oh, that's where that sort of experience is over there and here's me over here. But do you think there's a kind of, are we all touching on a sense of channeling when we're expressing that truth? Because for me, for example, there are certain environments that I'm in, certain times where, and I know where it's aligned to my passion, my purpose, whatever it is, sometimes not always, where my mouth's moving ahead of me. And I'm listening to it thinking, I'm supposed to be hearing this as well as whoever I'm, well, I don't even know if they're supposed to be hearing it, but I feel like this is for me. I don't know I'm saying this. Whereas the other thing where you've got your script, you've got your strategy for who's going to love this when I say it. But the bit where everything's coming out and you're almost like, oh my gosh, it's just coming. That to me feels like a channeling. And yet we all maybe have these experiences, but we sit here and go, oh, you know, we try and make an opinion on what you're going through, or we think it's over there somewhere, or it only happens to these people, or even if it happens at all. But I feel like we all have a touch point with this already in so many ways when we bring more awareness to it.
I agree. You know, I channeling for me, I have a defined way of looking at it, which to me, channeling is dictation. Inspiration, which is what you're describing, we all have and all have access to. And it's your true knowing. The guides say the true self knows the small self thinks. There's nothing wrong with the small self or the personality self, which, you know, we have to think. I don't know how to make a cake. I got to look up the instructions for the recipe. I don't know these things. But when I know how to make a cake, when I'm in my knowing, I'm just doing it. And when you're speaking like that, you're inspired and you're tapping into a well of knowing, which is yours. And if you're going to get that for yourself, that's in some ways how it starts. Once you get used to that and trusting that, you develop it like a muscle. It's available to you all the time. You just have to learn to trust it. And some of what gets in the way of that is fear. And the other thing that gets in the way of that is presumption, what's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not supposed to be doing this, so why entertain that thought? You know, well, you can, clearly, because you do.
Yeah. Beautiful. Amazing. Paul, that's an hour of just, I mean, that's flown by, but that's phenomenal. It's a bit like some of your, you were talking about the way you dictate the books. I heard you saying is that they come in short passages. And it's not until maybe later down the line that you get to see it in its entirety and it makes sense. For a little bit, this podcast, I think I've been sort of flying by my seat of my pants a bit. And by the end of this, I might have to rewatch it to kind of for it all to fit in. But it's been big and it's been very, very powerful. And I appreciate your time from over there. You're in Maui now, are you?
I am. Yes.
Yeah. Brilliant. Oh, well, I'm glad it's working out for you so thankful, grateful for what you've given us and wish you all the best. Now, one thing we will ask at the very end is where can people reach you if you want people to reach you? Is there somewhere we can direct people leave that to you?
Well, my website's just my name. It's paulselig.com. And there's a calendar of events up there. I'm online every week doing a class on Wednesdays. We record everything. So if you're in another time zone, we'll send you the transcript and the recording. And I'm actually going to be in the UK this summer. I'll be in London channeling for the first time since before COVID, and then in Dublin and, all around, I guess. So there's lots of stuff, and information on the books are there, the live streams and everything else. So you can find me there. And this was fun. This was a good conversation. Oh. Thank you for having me.
Once Amazing. Again, Kerry, what Johnny said, Paul, thanks so much for being generous with your time and really a tremendous hour. As Johnny said, absolutely whizzed by.
Amazing. Thanks, Paul. Thank you very much.